Welcome to Groundwork, community radio news, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire is produced in Montreal, on the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe Nations. I'm your host, Gretchen King, joining you from CKUT Radio. In this episode...
Safety is definitely an issue that isn't being addressed by the increase in security.
There are some students, especially racialized and Indigenous students, who are saying, I don't feel like I'm a part of this campus when I get the stare down, whenever I walk in the building, when I get woken up from napping, when I'm here late studying.
But first up, here are the headlines. Our first headline comes from Ome Salma Rahimtula with the Groundwire National Coordination Team.
Last week, French judges dismissed the allegations against Canadian Dr. Hassan Diab and ordered his immediate release from French detention. Dr. Diab is a Canadian citizen and sociology professor who lived in Ottawa and was extradited from Canada to France in November 2014 after a seven-year battle against the extradition to face allegations of a synagogue bomb attack in Paris in 1980. He was extradited from Canada even though the Canadian extradition judge described the evidence presented against Dr. Diab as very problematic, convoluted, illogical, and suspect. However, given the low threshold of evidence in Canada's extradition law, the judge felt compelled to order the extradition. An overwhelming body of evidence shows that Dr. Diab was not in France in 1980 when the attack was perpetrated. In April, Groundwire spoke with an Amnesty International representative about the lack of evidence in the case against Dr. Diab.
There was also secret intelligence evidence that even to this day, we don't know where that came from. There was handwriting evidence produced at the extradition hearing, but it was soon shown that the handwriting was not, in fact, that of Hassan Diab. It was somebody else. There were one or two other pieces of evidence that were produced, but which were later withdrawn by the French authorities.
After more than 3 years in solitary confinement in a French prison, Dr. Diab was set to be released from detention late last week. He has always maintained his innocence and strongly condemned the 1980 bomb attack. Dr. Diab's Canadian lawyers are now calling on the Canadian government to order a complete review of the Extradition Act and procedures that led to years of injustice for an innocent Canadian.
In our next headline, Michael Welch, contributor with the University of Winnipeg-based radio station CKUW 95.9 FM, reports on a recent documentary film screening showcasing a legendary and now long gone radical space in the heart of downtown Winnipeg.
On a cold Friday evening in mid-January, roughly 60 people, including anarchists, activists, and the curious, descended upon the B-Zone in downtown Winnipeg at 558 Ellis Avenue for a documentary screening of Alison Burdaney's 2017 film Mondragon. The event featured soup at 6 p.m. and the film at 7 p.m., followed by question-and-answer discussion with the filmmaker. The film itself was short and sweet with a runtime of 29 minutes. There were tears in the eyes of many in attendance, and not just those depicted on the screen. Such was the emotional impact of Mondragon's closure felt by many in the community. Steve Kirk is one of the collective members who helped establish the B-Zone and screened the doc.
She worked there in its penultimate year, I think, and has done a really good job of balancing the ideals that that inspired that project with the gritty day-to-day realities of running an anti-capitalist business in this world, in this economy. If you were coming from a radical perspective, I feel like it was really easy to throw an event at Mondragon, and I'm really hoping that B-Zone can do a similar sort of thing.
Hopes are high that the new B-Zone will pick up where Mondragon left off as a launching pad for a fresh, new era in Winnipeg activism and anti-establishment economics. From downtown Winnipeg on the occupied territory of the Anishinaabe and the Nihiwak and the homeland of the Métis Nation, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
That headline was produced by contributor Michael Welch with the assistance of CKUW News Director Jarrett Cole. Our final headline comes from CKUT's Prison Radio.
Advocates in the Maritimes are urging the Government of Canada to stop the deportation of former child refugee Abdul Qadir Abdi. Abdul Qadir Abdi came to Canada at the age of 6 with his sister and 2 aunts, all as jointly sponsored refugees fleeing Somalia. Abdi became a permanent ward of the state at the age of 7 years old. The Department of Community Services, which is responsible for child protection in Nova Scotia, did not make a citizenship application for Abdi and his sister. The deputy minister of that department recently stated that Canada has no policies for children in its care who are non-citizens. The Department of Community Services does not expect to fix this policy gap until March of next year. Abdul Abdi can't wait. He's currently in detention, away from his daughter and family, awaiting deportation to a country where he cannot speak the language. A former child refugee and long-term permanent resident of Canada, Abdi is in segregation while awaiting deportation. Abdi recently lost his detention review hearing and as a result will remain at the Madawaska Regional Correctional Center in Saint-Hilaire, New Brunswick. Abdul Abdi's lawyer, Benjamin Perryman, stated, "It is concerning that the minister and the immigration division are barging ahead with an admissibility hearing because the division does not have jurisdiction to consider the charter and international human rights laws issues that are raised in this case. Those issues arise from the fact that Mr. Abdi is facing deportation because he is a non-citizen, and he is a non-citizen because Children's Services failed to apply for citizenship on his behalf." Advocates for Abdulkader Abdi are demanding that the Minister of Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship acknowledge that Canada has an international human rights obligation to provide special protection for non-citizen children in care, ensuring that all non-citizen children who are permanently in care are provided Canadian citizenship. Acknowledge that Canada has an international human rights obligation not to deport long-term permanent residents who came to Canada as young children and were denied citizenship by the inaction of Children's Services and Canada, and halt the deportation of all former children in care who were denied the protections of citizenship and became inadmissible to Canada. For more information on how to get involved in the campaign to stop Abdulkader Abdi's deportation, contact the Black Power Hour at theblackpowerhour@gmail.com.
That's it for headlines. You're still listening to Groundwire. We'll be right back after this. You just heard Northern Cree's recording, Cutting Edge, from the award-winning album It's a Cree Thing, Cree Round Dance Songs. Welcome back to Groundwire, your source for news from the ground up, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca and airing on your community radio station. Now it's time for our feature stories. A significant security breach at the University of Winnipeg last November has raised concerns among campus and community members about how administration efforts to protect students could potentially alter the fundamental character of this unique downtown institution. Michael Welch, contributor with radio station CKUW 95.9 FM, based out of that university, brings Groundwire the details.
Last year, on an early November evening, a stranger reportedly entered the main campus of the University of Winnipeg, approached a university student working in the vicinity, and attempted to make off with his laptop computer. When the student resisted, the stranger stabbed him and grabbed his cell phone instead. A number of campus community members, having witnessed the altercation, confronted the suspect outside the entrance of the building, and one of them also got assaulted. The perpetrator was eventually apprehended by authorities later in the evening. However, the shocking incident made headlines in the city the next day and prompted the university administration to rethink and revisit how they could prevent any similar incidents from happening in the future. Students quoted in the press mentioned suggestions like an ID card, which could, in theory, deny admittance to all but registered students and faculty. Are there other, better ways of improving safety on campus? I approached some members of the campus community on the weekend outside of regular class hours and got them to share their thoughts about the security situation at the university.
My name is Haneen, and I study conflict resolutions and psychology. I think increasing the amount of security on campus is exactly what they should be doing. But what I think that what they can be doing differently is offer kind of mental health support for the people who have been affected by these situations, or even bystanders who have witnessed these kind of situations.
Often what you see the university security engaging in is like not actually stopping unsafe behavior. A lot of what they do is just harass homeless people who come inside because it's minus 30 degrees outside, and they're not protecting anyone. They just make people uncomfortable and make people like less safe by forcing people outside who just want to be warm, who aren't threatening anyone. I think safety is definitely an issue that isn't being addressed by the increase in security.
My name is Tanis. I'm DJ Liar. I have a radio program called Listening Pleasures. Tuesdays from 11 till midnight. I'm here usually around 10 o'clock, and I don't leave till maybe 12:30 sometimes. I've never really encountered anyone either on the campus on the outside or on the inside at that hour. Like, usually everyone's gone home. I still don't really feel threatened, but that's just because the doors lock at 11. So anyone coming in is usually coming in with me.
Laura Geringer is the president of the University of Winnipeg Student Union.
I don't want to say that students, concerns are unfounded, but it was just one situation. When we were first talking about this with the administration and the security office, I took some time to talk to students around our offices, even in the Bowman Center, which is in the basement, and it is isolated in some ways. So I talked to some people who study there often and usually alone. A lot of them said, it's really great to see more security guards. They're more present. They're more visible. It makes me feel better. But I think what stood out the most is that there are some students, especially racialized and Indigenous students, who are saying, I don't feel like I'm a part of this campus when I get the stare down, whenever I walk in the building, when I get checked for my ID when I come onto the campus, when I get woken up from napping when I'm here late studying. Those are things that are not okay. And those concerns have been raised with the head of security. But it has to be... We can't close ourselves off, and we can't, we can't have people not feeling like they're part of this campus when this is why they're here. Yeah, there are some places like offices and things like that that maybe should, just be accessed by key cards late at night. Yeah. There's some places on campus where it's not necessary to be at 9 o'clock, but it's still... it kind of speaks to this broader idea that this space is not welcoming. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what we really need to work on, and, making sure that everyone is feeling safe on campus. And safety means different things for different people, too. So,
according to Chris Miniger, senior executive officer at the University of Winnipeg and advisor to the president, the administration has embarked on a review of their security procedures and is planning to tap the input of the broader campus community this winter. From the heart of downtown Winnipeg on the occupied territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Nihiyawak and the homeland of the Métis Nation, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
Thanks to CKUW for that report. That's it for features. We'll be right back after this. Since 2008, Groundwire has been on air, produced and distributed by an experienced team of community radio news volunteers. The national coordination team is seeking new members of all experiences who would like to join in the collaborative production of Canada's only syndicated community radio news program. Groundwire is an award-winning program produced bi-weekly by and for community radio stations. Groundwire is a reliable, high-quality newscast dedicated to grassroots coverage, offering social justice views on issues that engage local and national audiences. Groundwire's priority is to connect diverse communities from coast to coast to coast and encourage self-representation. With this volunteer position, Groundwire offers an excellent opportunity to network at a national level with community media journalists and community radio stations across Canada. Join the Groundwire National Coordination Team. Visit www.groundwirenews.ca and click on Contribute for details. Welcome back to Groundwire, your source for independent grassroots news, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca and airing on your community radio station. Now it's time for our community radio report. In 2017, Nipivut, the Montreal Inuit radio show, aired on CKUT, won the National Campus Community Radio Association, or NCRA, Community Development Award. In this feature, we'll hear from Annie Pusikti, host of the Nipivut radio show, speaking with Inuit visual artist and former producer with Nipivut, Stefan Puskas, about their program. They share the story of why Inuit in Montreal need a community radio show.
Hi, my name is Annie Pisuti. I'm Inuk from Iqaluit. I live in Montreal. I've been there for 30 years. I host an Inuititu radio show called Nipivut in Montreal. The reason I wanted to be a host was because I used to work with the homeless in Montreal, and a lot of the Inuit up north and in the south don't hear from each other, and I wanted to be their voice so that their family can hear their children or their siblings, whatever. And that is the reason why I said I can do the job. I can do it. It was on Facebook. I replied to Facebook, and that's how I ended up being a host for Nipivut. And so that's me. I got me.
Hi, I'm Stefan Gluvak-Pushkash, one of the founding producers for Nipivut, and Nipivut came out of the research project Nunalijawak. It's a Shirk-funded research project out of the Department of Anthropology at Concordia. And we can talk a little bit later about the history of Nipivut as well, too, but yeah, that's about it.
Well, I believe you're going to be first on the panel presenting,
that's right.
So please feel free.
Never mind, yeah. So I'm an Inuk from Yellowknife. My family is from Nunavut, from the Kivalliq region. I started on the project on Nunalijawak with Mark Watson. The research project was about trying to answer the question why Montreal is so different compared to Ottawa. The two populations for the Inuit communities are very similar. The two cities are so close to each other, but in Ottawa, they have so much programs and services for the Inuit community, and Montreal has had very little. I believe it also kind of started as well from the Villeray incident of 2010. In Montreal, in the neighborhood of Villeray, 2010, basically an Inuit organization called Makivik tried to buy an old Chinese hospital that was closed down, and they wanted to reopen it to serve Inuit patients who come down for health services because there's no hospitals in northern Quebec. But a lot of the community in Villeray started handing out flyers and a petition basically saying they don't want Inuit in their own neighborhood. And that was one of the things I believe that kind of sparked this research project. Like, how could it kind of come to this where this type of discrimination is so open in Montreal? And then since then there's been another number of other things that's been happening as well, too. Like, you know, last spring, a police officer came to my friend's door and just handed a flyer and said, if you see any homeless people, don't be afraid to call 911. So there's been instances like that that's been happening. And part of the research project was learning about the history, researching the history of Inuit in Montreal, but also as an action-based community research project, actually to try to enact some change, some positive difference in the Inuit community in Montreal. We originally wanted to do a museum exhibit at the McCord, but things kind of fell through a bit with those plans, and you know, we were trying to think about what else we can do, and the idea about Montreal Inuit radio station kind of came up, you know, because basically Iqaluit in Nunavut has a French radio station called Sefret, and you know, we just kind of asked, well, why doesn't Montreal have an Inuit radio station? And we started thinking about a lot of the positives about having an Inuit community radio station or radio show. Can help connect Inuit in the community when we don't have our own neighborhood, where Inuit are really spread out across the city. It could also provide a voice to Inuit because, you know, at least in Montreal, a lot of the news reports and stuff, a lot of the news coverage, journalists talk about Inuit, they actually don't talk with Inuit. So it could provide Inuit actual voice to speak for themselves, have a form of self-representation. It could help combat a lot of these negative stereotypes that we've been encountering in the city. And it could hopefully help open a dialogue as well. Connect Inuit from the south to the north, as well as within our own city, and hopefully as well connect Inuit with non-Inuit. Because really there wasn't really many other outlets where non-Inuit, non-Indigenous people in Montreal could actually hear Inuktitut, or actually hear Inuit talking, basically. So that's basically how it started. It happened very, very quickly. That happened 2 years ago when we had the idea. Within 2 months, we started having radio production workshops at CKUT. CKUT was very accommodating. Like it was just passed unanimously for CKUT to adopt it. And we share a slot with IRCAR. What's the show again? Native Solidarity News. So IRCAR is a Mohawk journalist at CQUT, and he has his own show, and he kind of wanted to take a step back. So he was willing to share his time slot with us. So we have our show every second Tuesday on CQUT from 6 to 7. From there, we actually also upload and post our shows on SoundCloud and isuma.tv. And we get a lot of Inuit from the north accessing our show on Isuma, mainly because Isuma is a network where in the Inuit communities up north, where there's a lot of slow internet speeds and very expensive internet access, Isuma kind of works around that, where they have their own kind of internal network in the communities. So we get a lot of listeners on Isuma, and we get a lot of listeners as well elsewhere through SoundCloud. We also have a Facebook presence where we do you know, mention a lot of these things that we're doing, activities or just reminders about the show. And Annie has been our host since the very beginning.
I got nothing. I like talking when there's no people around to the microphone, but it's very hard for me when there's a people present, so... He's doing very well.
When it comes to breaking barriers, I think that's what we were talking about. It was basically, especially in the South, like there, you know, a lot of our nation's broadcasters don't have any Inuit programming when it comes to Indigenous programming. For example, CBC's national programming, Indigenous national programming, is all First Nations focused or First Nations based. Like CBC Indigenous, entire First Nations team. CBC Unreserved, Turtle Island Reads, Revision Quest. They're all references. Oh, and there's also New Fire, another national Indigenous radio show. They're all references to First Nations culture, First Nations focus, led by First Nations people, but there's no Inuit programming. There's a lot of Inuit programming in the north, but that ignores the fact that over 25% of the Inuit population in Canada live outside of Inuit Nunangat. They live in southern Canada. So Nipivut is actually the first Inuit community radio show in southern Canada. As far as I know, there was one Indigenous radio show coming out of Carleton where they did have some slots for an Indigenous journalist, Indigenous broadcaster, but it wasn't solely an Inuit radio show.
I would love to hear any.
Can I speak in my language? In the dog out and the tartan of Halimagata, it was a rigaco. Halono Yatakango to Palogama. In the two apples, okay, I'm going to speak English now. my show is, I speak Inuktitut a lot in my show, and the Inuit that I interview, they will speak Inuktitut. Some don't speak Inuktitut, so I'll speak with them in English, but they're still Inuit. We're still Inuit. Some of us just don't carry our language anymore. Usually, I try to get what's happening, the events that are happening, or a couple of times I've had live shows where they phone in, which was very fun. I know that the Inuit of Montreal appreciate our show. So like I said, I am the voice for the Inuit. And I enjoy my show. I was very nervous the first time I was on the air. My voice was like, wah, 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 but I made it. It's getting better. Like, now I can speak a little bit better without having that. So, like I said, I don't know what more to say. It's the fans doing so well.
Well, we can talk about as well plans for the future. So, Nipivut has been around for almost 2 years now. Our first show was October 6, 2015. And right now we're looking at expanding. Since Nipivut's been on air, other Inuit and other communities in Canada, southern Canada, have been telling actually a lot of their Inuit community organizations, like Tungasuvingat Inuit here in Ottawa, you know, Montreal has an Inuit radio show, why don't we have an Inuit radio show here? So actually on Monday, Annie and our colleague David will be providing a radio broadcasting workshop for the Inuit community in Ottawa with hopes that we can start building an Inuit radio show here as well. And there's been interest in Edmonton with the Inuit community in Edmonton to have their own radio show. So we don't really have national programming in Inuktitut or national Inuit programming, but we definitely have interest in other cities with other Inuit communities to have them start producing their own content as well.
The future for you?
Well, I guess my future is still I'm going to be with Nipivut. I have no intentions of leaving Nipivut for now. And hopefully there'll be other Inuit willing to do the same thing, being radio hosts. That would be wonderful.
You were just listening to Annie and Stefan from Nipivut. Their program airs on Tuesdays. Visit www.ckut.ca to listen to Nipivut's archive. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by the National Coordination Team in Montreal on the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe Nations. Music this week was by Northern Cree. We thank all of our amazing contributors who were part of this episode. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at www.groundwirenews.ca.